Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Steindl. Welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt. It is an honor and a privilege, and terribly exciting, for me to introduce to you today's guest, Professor Stephen Rolnick. Steve is a clinical psychologist and honorary distinguished professor at the School of Medicine, Cardiff University, and he's the co-founder of Motivational Interviewing, along with Professor Bill Miller. He's had a remarkable career, including clinical service, training others, and researching motivational interviewing, or in other words, how to have helpful conversations in various settings and all around the world. Steve has loomed large throughout my professional career. The original book by Miller and Rolnick, Motivational Interviewing, Preparing People to Change Addictive Behavior, was published in 1991, just as I was completing my undergraduate studies and moving into postgraduate studies in clinical psychology. My PhD then used motivational interviewing to work with veterans who were experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder and alcohol dependence. And it was midway through my PhD that Miller and Rolnick published their second edition in 2002. Then there was a third edition in 2013, and now a fourth edition in 2023, Motivational Interviewing, Helping People Change and Grow. He's authored or co-authored several other influential books on motivational interviewing and its application in healthcare, sports, and schools. I'll put links to Steve's books in the description below. In this conversation, I get to ask him about motivational interviewing and compassion, empathy, sympathy, how to effectively give advice, how to best be helpful, as well as how to reduce the chance of unintentionally causing harm. And so I bring you Professor Stephen Rolnick. All right, Professor Stephen Rolnick, welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt.
No, thanks very much. Thanks very much.
Your name has loomed large in my professional life. I was just seeing that the first motivational interviewing book was published in 91, and I started my master's in clinical psych in 93. So, of course, MI was the thing that we kind of got onto. And I think you know Ross Young, Professor Ross Young. He was my PhD supervisor. So he was very keen on motivational interviewing all the way back then.
Wow, I do remember Ross. Give him my best wishes if you see him. He had a sparkling intellect.
Yes, very smart and rather cheeky, to be honest. But I thought we might start there because certainly you're very well known for motivational interviewing, and one of the things that came into the spirit of MI, at least in a more formal way, I think, in the third edition, was the notion of compassion. And so I wondered if you could perhaps, yeah, just tell us a little bit about compassion, how it became a part of the MI spirit, how you're sort of seeing compassion in that context, first of all.
That, I mean, with the benefit of hindsight and a little bit of wisdom, I can see it now, right? I didn't at the time. But, you know, when we started with motivational interviewing, indeed in Australia, 89 and 90, 91, we were in the narrow field of like addiction treatment.
Mm.
That first edition was written as kind of addiction psychologists. So there was, looking back, there was no question we were motivated by compassion because we were helping folk overcome addiction, right? So it never entered our heads to sort of say anything about compassion. Then there was the second edition, probably about 10 years later. And what had happened then was that MI had expanded in reach to some extent, deliberate on my part, in that I was working in healthcare and the settings in which it could be used were incredibly diverse, including in healthcare. And I was aware of wonderful colleagues in the Mint Group, Motivational Interviewing Network of Trainers, who were working in criminal justice, social care, you name it. Yet all of these settings involved being really helpful to people. These were therapists, counselors, practitioners, presumably motivated by compassion, but I don't think it became front and center for us or me. However, it then became apparent that people thought that something like motivational interviewing could be used to sell cars or
Yes.
could be used. So these kind of ethical discussions and itches, I call them ethical itches, were being scratched, right? And I was scratching them and wondering, hang on, this is like getting out of hand. This is not really what we were wanting. And so in, I think it was the third edition, it seemed fairly obvious then, instead of immersing ourselves in our thinking and writing in what are these ethical issues, and became incredibly complicated. It seemed obvious to me, and Bill agreed, Bill Miller, who really was the founder of motivational interviewing, that if we just insert the word compassion in there, it at a stroke kind of eliminates someone who's maybe wanting to sell cars or manipulate people. So I think that's what happened. To avoid motivational interviewing being seen as a form of manipulation.
Yes, even just the notion of helping people change versus getting people to change or something like that. The compassionate motivation is perhaps really what we want to cultivate behind what we're doing with MI and to sort of be helpful for the person. I know in the third edition, there's a few little lines that I recall, like having your heart in the right place, I think is one of the things that it says there. But also, doing things as the practitioner in the service of the person that you're working with and in the service of their health and well-being. I mean, how would you kind of flesh that out or kind of define compassion? Can you elaborate there?
Yeah, I can't say I suppose I see it as a desire to be of help to other people. I mean, maybe that's a bit simple, but it's a feeling or a motive inside us. So my sense is to start with looking in the mirror, so to speak, and noticing the way I'm feeling. And if it's not really the main driver of the way I'm trying to be helpful, well, that's important to notice because I could slip into trying to do things to or on people that are less helpful if it's not driven by that. So, I think it's a feeling. And it can go in different directions. I've noticed that inside myself and in other people. And I guess we'll be unpacking that quite a bit today because firstly, that can end up harming people. Helping myself and others whom I mentor, it's mostly mentoring I'm doing now. Notice that feeling of compassion, and then behave accordingly with the person they're speaking to. It's quite a nuanced business, and I'm searching for and finding simpler ways of dealing with that myself more recently. But that's like,
It is interesting. It's like as you and Bill sort of you arrived at this notion that if we sort of pop that in there, in a way, it kind of puts a salve on the ethical itch or something. I'm just trying to go with your metaphor there, but it does. It kind of offers something of a solution there. But then the moment you actually zoom in on that word and the compassion piece, it sort of opens up again, doesn't it? Because there is so much potentially to it. I really liked how you said it's kind of a feeling, but it's kind of a motivation itself in a way. It's a motivation to be helpful, but then, that's kind of tricky, to know how to do that, how to be helpful.
That's exactly our field, yeah.
What do you think about compassion and empathy?
Oh, wow. That's a good one. I'll have to think off the top of my head. I think empathy is a way of realizing compassion, and it's a very good way. It's not the only way of realizing compassion, but it's a fabulous way of doing it, n not only in the it, certainly in the start of a conversation. It's incredibly helpful. But as you probably know, that empathies has other uses, and when a conversation is about change and you're trying to be helpful to somebody, empathic listening, viewed as a skill, is a tremendous driver of comfort for the person you're speaking to, so that they can be brave and bold enough to kind of feel understood and clarify how change might come about. I mean, that's MI in one sentence. Okay. But I am puzzled by, with empathy, by a lack of clarity and consensus about what it actually means and involves in practice and conversation. I tell you what, I notice, which is that some of the people I mentor and speak to get a bit troubled with something. And I think looking back at my career and my clinical practice, I burnt out because I didn't understand this, which is empathy is sometimes understood as putting yourself in someone else's shoes. Fine. Imagining the experience, fine. But then you can distinguish between, if you like, emotional and cognitive empathy. And emotional empathy, which is, I feel your pain, I kind of see them as two dials, if you like. And I reckon I burnt out in clinical practice because that dial was a bit too high. And so I was feeling a lot of other people's pain. And, it drained me. Now, I also find that the other dial, which is more like cognitive empathy, protects me from that. So I reach to understand someone's experience, to use empathic listening as a skill to state and offer to them my understanding of their experience, but I'm not feeling their pain. And, these two dials, they're not completely separate, but I find that the emotional one, I can turn up a wee bit, but then go, boop, just turn it down a wee bit and turn the cognitive empathy one up. And I find that's a more satisfying way of using empathic listening for me and preventing me feeling too much of other people's pain. And I would argue, I wonder whether I could state this provocatively. It's probably more helpful. Okay. It's probably more helpful. So that in the work I'm doing at the moment, in sport, it's not very different to clinical work. It's just a lot more informal and friendly and stuff. These characters offload a whole load of stuff onto me that's unbelievable, right? Almost literally sometimes, because of the high octane, toxic, crazy world that they live and work in. And I don't feel too much of that, you know. I don't, you know, kind of, I reckon if I ask them, which I frequently do, hey, listen, man, what's helpful here? What is currently helpful about what we're talking about? What was helpful? They don't refer to, oh, you feel my pain. You know, they kind of appreciate the fact that I get them, which I think is more cognitive empathy. So your question was about compassion and empathy. And I think in either case, whatever dial it is, empathy is very useful, but it's not the only way of being helpful. There are other ways of realizing the compassion I feel besides empathy. Okay, so shall I give you a concrete example?
Yeah, I'm very curious.
Yeah. Oh no, it's just on a WhatsApp message, because that's how we are in sport. But I saw a guy yesterday clearly struggling. They were out practicing and I could see, you know, I know him quite well, right? So I sent him a message. Okay. Last night, I think I sent him a message just saying, ba 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 ba, full stop. Remember, I've got your back. Okay, which is a way of saying, look, I'm here for you. And wow, the text message I got this morning was in response to, I got your back. Now, that's not empathic listening, but it is driven by compassion. And it's a message about helpfulness that clearly had a powerful impact on him this morning, such that when I see him later, he'll throw his arms around me and say, thanks for the message. But I'm not using empathy. I mean, I must have used it yesterday to notice, right?
That's what I was thinking. Yes. Yeah.
I must have, but in conversation with him probably today, we might be talking, I might not be using so much empathy as helping him to clarify how to approach the situation in that situation. It could get very, I could be giving him quite a lot of advice. Okay. And that advice might include empathic listening, but that's not at the heart of what's probably going to happen. So I'm just saying that empathy is maybe not the only way of being helpful, because I think sending the message as an act, as a behavior, was helpful. Doing things for other people because they know you've got their back and you've been kind and practical is another way. Giving someone a gift is a way of practicing compassion. So I see compassion as, I suppose, is much broader than just using empathy. There's an answer to your question, but maybe, you know.
No, I love it. And it's sort of very thought-provoking. It's kind of, empathy is something of a skill, isn't it? It might be an affective empathy or emotional empathy aspect to the skill, or it might be a cognitive empathy. It might be something we achieve through listening, but it might just be something we achieve through our eyes, through watching the person. You were able to, in a sense, empathize through your eyes and rather than your ears or something. And it's almost like empathy plus action is somewhere where we arrive at compassion in a way. The empathy helps to understand that perhaps there is suffering there, and then the action is to help alleviate it.
Yeah, and Terry Moyers, our friend and colleague, makes an interesting distinction between, as she does, she's a very clear, emphatic thinker, between internal and external.
Yeah.
So there's the internal experience of empathy, okay, whether cognitive or emotional, and then there's the external, what you do and say about it. And I suspect that kind of helpfulness is driven by compassion entirely.
Yes, yeah, that's sort of my sense too, that compassion is the motivation behind it. Because of course, empathy as a skill can also be used for more nefarious kind of motives or competitive motives. The poker player who might use empathic sort of skills to understand his or her opponent and therefore beat them. So it might be brought to competitive motivations or even cruel motivations. I know Paul Gilbert sort of says the last thing you want is an empathic torturer because they would really know, how to make you suffer, I suppose. What do you think of that idea that empathy as a skill can be brought to other motivations?
I don't know. I'm confused about it. I know somebody wrote a book about the dangers of empathy. And to be honest, I flick read it about 10, 15 years ago. But, there's lots of, I've noticed that, how can I put it? Look, a few weeks ago, I found myself in an organized gathering of Jews and Muslims, because I'm Jewish. And leaders of the local Muslim community and some people in the Jewish community were asked to come sit around and try and heal. Okay, powerful stuff, eh? Really, we had to listen to each other's stories. Okay, now this was a very unusual and special group of people who were making an effort to empathize with others. Okay, and the empathy in the room was used to very good effect. However, their stories were of people on both sides being angry out there. Okay. They were talking about and quite serious stuff, right? And we're dangerous and serious stuff, people being angry. And so what I then of course wondered and didn't say anything was that if you empathize, if something horrible happens to your group, to your tribe, you can empathize with your tribe to such an extent that it blinds your perception and compassion for the other side. We need to look no further than what's going on in Israel and Palestine to see the disastrous impact of that mistake. Now, you can meet people who are very empathic and compassionate on either side of that conflict, and find that their empathy is being used in that way. So that's quite an extreme example, but it's pretty current.
And I think that's part of what I think it was Paul Bloom who wrote Against Empathy. And that's kind of a little bit of a part of what his thesis was that sometimes empathy can be tricky because we're sort of moved by the emotion of the experience. We're sort of resonating with somebody and feeling something. And so then that might mean that we're not making as rational or wise a decision in terms of how to act. And a dear colleague of mine, James Kirby, has done quite a bit of work looking at likability as a kind of a inhibitor or facilitator of compassion, that the more we like someone, the more we feel likely to want to help, basically. I mean, it's just sort of a part of the species almost. And so there are little kind of sort of dangers there, aren't there, in terms of the way that our brains process things like empathy and how that then influences our compassion.
I'm with you entirely. Yeah. And that likability concept is something we could return to if you like.
Yeah. Well, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm busy writing a book on giving advice. Okay.
Exciting.
Sorry.
Exciting. I'm looking forward to
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's quite a journey. It's for lay people. It's not for counselors, and and I noticed that even with the most, this is in my work in sport, I suppose, even with the most obnoxious and difficult and apparently hostile individuals, right? If I don't feel the potential for affection for them, I must not go near it. Okay.
Ah.
And that's like ability, right? The audience,
Yes.
the potential to like and respect someone, and to see them as someone whom I could like and respect. If I don't have that feeling, then I don't think it's going to be helpful to give them advice. And I think, sadly, most advice that's emitted in so many settings doesn't carry that awareness. I've experienced that in school, and I've seen it in classrooms by, teachers. Advice doesn't land well if someone doesn't feel liked.
I imagine almost advice becomes tricky at both ends of that spectrum, whether you really kind of dislike a person, that might have some particular implications for your advice. But if you really like that person, perhaps that can be a double-edged sword as well.
That's beautifully put. That's very helpful. Yeah, because it can, that's very helpful and nuanced, Stan. Because that is the case, that earnestly wanting to help someone who you really, really like can be unhelpful. Like a partner who comes back from work and is feeling incredibly stressed and talk blah 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 blah, and that's a very common thing. That so you hear this and you love this person, and so you step in with advice when it's the last thing they need, and is
Yes.
not helpful. Yeah. So it has got two sides.
The Dalai Lama, I think, says, if you want to practice compassion, it's not with people we love, but with our enemies. Those are the ones who give us the most trouble, and that's who can give us the most opportunities to practice compassion. But I actually feel like those we love are also challenging, because we've got so much skin in the game and there feels like so much at stake, and it feels very difficult to, kind of step back a bit and respect their choices. I mean, I have a son who's now 19 and an adult and whatever, but we had our fair share of battles over maths, for example, mathematics study or something, because I really wanted him to have a good time of school and to do well and whatever, and he really would resist me and push back despite all that you've taught me about motivational interviewing. It was hard when it's your own child, I guess.
Yeah, so then it sounds like this, and I know the experience, believe me, my God, daily. I got four kids daily, current. There are
Yes.
other drivers besides compassion that lead you to behave the way you do. Okay. And some of those
Ah.
drivers, I wonder, impatience, love, all
Fear.
sorts of. Fear is a good one. Yeah, fear is a great one. Feeling like someone's going down the wrong road, right?
Yes, yeah.
Anyway, so it's a bit nuanced, and no, but that's very helpful what you say about giving advice. But there you go. I don't know why we got onto that subject. Yeah, I can see one link. Okay, why we might have been talking about giving advice, which is that I've seen so many sports coaches, parents, and people adopt the position of the deficit, what I call the deficit detective. Okay. See problem, fix it. And in motivational interviewing, we've come up with this phrase called the fixing reflex or the writing reflex. It's not an invention. It's just translating something we can see in everyday life. You got a problem, see the problem, I got the answer. And I think this is incredibly widespread. Incredibly widespread. And I see it every day at work in sport. When I worked on that book for school teachers, it runs right through schools and indeed parenting. There's a lot of parents who just kind of see problem, or don't do this, do that. And it's driven by compassion, you know, presumably, and it's unhelpful.
Yeah. Unwise or unskillful compassion or something like that. The motivation, the engagement with the suffering is there, but the compassionate action piece is not quite hitting the mark.
I agree, Stan. Spot on. And that's a very sad, that's why I'm writing this book.
Yeah.
To try and translate some simple ideas about how you can start somewhere good and then carry on.
Yes.
And get it right.
Because giving advice absolutely can be compassionate action. I mean, that can be something that helps to alleviate or prevent suffering.
As can practicing empathy.
The empathy, empathic listening. In fact, in some ways, the empathic listening is kind of like really a powerful core way to express our compassion in a way.
Yeah, we're agreeing, which is enjoyable.
Here's another one which maybe we might disagree on, I don't know. What do you think about sympathy?
Don't know, actually. I really don't know. Yeah, I think that's a word that is like empathy is not, there's not a lot of consensus. Isn't sympathy feeling sorry for someone, to be blunt?
Yeah, I do like the topic of sympathy because there is a little bit of a thing amongst therapists, I guess at least, that sort of empathy good, sympathy bad kind of thing. You know, that somehow sympathy is too much like pity or sort of feeling sorry for somebody. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I'm a bit confused about it. But like that guy that I saw yesterday, I felt really sorry for him. He's flipping lost. He was flipping lost, man.
Yeah.
And I felt sorry for him, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yes.
You know, that feeling sorry for him was also, there was also empathy involved there because I had to try and imagine his experience. But I thought, oh, shit, that's rough. I feel sorry for this guy. I'm going to send him a message.
Aha. Now, this is really cool. I think this is really cool because we might empathize with someone, which is kind of understanding their experience of something. But it's the kind of sympathizing with it. It's when we feel moved by what they're going through that actually takes us to act. You know, the sympathy is almost like a part of what brings us from empathy to action, maybe, or something like that.
Yeah, then they're kind of linked, aren't they? Because I couldn't sympathize with him without being able to empathize, imagine his experience.
That's
but
true.
I suppose I suppose the folk who are critical about sympathy are thinking about, I imagine they're thinking about, it's not always helpful for a receiver to feel sympathy all the time. It's not enough for people to need more than that. I wonder, I don't know.
Yeah. I've worked a lot with, for example, veterans, men who've been deployed and experienced combat trauma and so on. And often they will say things like that, that they'll say, you know, I don't want your sympathy sort of thing, you know, and it sort of comes along with some sort of connotation like that. You know, they don't want people being too, I don't know, kind of fluffy about it, or, oh, I'm so sorry for you. Like that feels very uncomfortable.
Yeah, there's probably a feeling of being belittled or patronized.
Mm.
and empowered, you know. And so the excessive use of sympathy can end up being patronizing and belittling and disempowering. But I don't think with the guy I saw yesterday, it was that. I felt
No.
this tremendous sympathy for him. I sent him a message, and it's the "I got your back" that clearly made a difference. So I think the degree of sympathy is fine. Just don't overdo it, you know.
Well, it's a little bit like empathy, I guess, now that you say that. Like with empathy, you've got your dials and you're kind of being aware, or we're trying to be self-aware about our empathy, and perhaps sympathy, there's a dial there as well, where we're trying to have a little bit of, we want to have a bit of sympathy for the person, but we just don't want to. And maybe Terry's point about the internal and the external is important there as well with sympathy. You know, the internal aspect of sympathy is where we really feel moved by what they're going through, touched by that. We feel sorry in a sense. But the external is, we also have to be quite careful there and not do it in a way that's too much, or, you know, that puts the person off.
I mean, you might think, listening to our conversation, that we've got to be hell of a clever and smart and skillful to navigate all this complexity. And yet, like, I must say, with the benefit of hindsight, I've got much simpler in my old age, right? So, like, now, and I think it's helpful. What I'm about to say, I've noticed in my mentoring of other coaches, elite coaches in soccer and cricket, which is just to be completely open with people. So if you want to be helpful, rather than sit and agonize over the dials and which dial should I this or that, just ask them. Just
Love it.
ask them. Just say, and I do this routinely now. And I got a guy at the moment who's a lot of fun, and he's very creative and expressive and famous and successful in his sport. And I said to him one day, "Has this been helpful?" He said, "Oh God, it's gone on too long." Right? So I said, "So what was helpful about it? Ba 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 ba." But so I make an empathic listening statement, but it's gone on too long. "Yeah, it's gone on much too long." So I say, "So what will be helpful?" He said, "10 minutes." Well, now the joke is, when I saw him yesterday, we walked off the field together. And he said, "Perfect length, Steve. I'll talk to you between now and the time we get to the perimeter, and then I'm going to say goodbye," right? So, but it was this affectionate checking in with people at all stages of a conversation about, is this helpful, right? What would be more helpful? What would be less helpful? And they tell you. And so I suppose that's perfectly consistent with motivational interviewing, which is, rather than agonize myself about being helpful, the wisdom is inside the person you're speaking to. So ask them. Don't get all caught up in clutter in your own head and how you can be a good therapist or good whatever. Just ask. Anyway, that's the simplicity of an old man's thinking.
No, I think that's actually so important. And of course, it's a big part of effective therapists these days, isn't it? Is to be able to get feedback on, you know, how am I going in the sessions, and getting feedback from our clients, but also feedback on outcome as well. You know, that the more we can sort of see, are we being helpful in a way that works for the person, and that is actually helping them to achieve the outcomes they want, then that sort of, you know, that's, but if we're not, then maybe something has to change.
I think what we're approaching is the subject of helpfulness. Okay. I'm not thinking just of therapists. I'm thinking of school teachers and sports coaches, parents, more complicated because of our emotional investments in the relationship. But I think a tremendous amount of harm is done through not asking people some simple questions. Okay. So in some of the sport that I've been close to, I noticed coaches just being deficit detectives all the time, right? And I went into one environment and decided to ask every coach one question, right? With affection and respect, which is, how do you ever ask the players how they like to be coached? Okay. I asked every coaches, and I never came across one coach who's ever asked that question of a player. Now, that's because they reckon they know how to coach, right? And I think being helpful involves clarifying these things with people. So if you do ask a player or a person or a school student, how do you like to be taught, to be treated, to be coached? You'll get some tremendous answers, and then you can maximize the effectiveness of what of your helpfulness. So I think we're approaching a subject which has not been addressed adequately, which is helpfulness. I'm not going to write the book. I reckon once I've done the advice book, I'll probably stop, right? But if I could wave a magic wand, it would be for there to be clarity about what helpfulness really is. And what I've noticed looking back, and I've been part of it with regret, is the fragmentation of helpfulness in the therapy field, where everybody's got this kind of form of therapy. And rather than clarity about what helpfulness is, there was somebody whose name I've forgotten who, in the 70s and 80s, he was actually working in business, who wrote a book on the subject, which I thought was fantastic. But I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. It'll come to me.
Steve emailed me later to let me know that it was Jared Egan's The Skilled Helper, which is currently in its 11th edition. I think it does just kind of come to that notion of helpfulness and what is it to be helpful and how that's a kind of a real partnership between the person who's helping and the person being helped and that the person being helped has a lot of that intrinsic wisdom. And so we want to do a kind of a conversation or something where we're able to bring all of that to the surface and to kind of a guided discovery thing together, isn't it? You know, just sort of working our way to the kind of just what's going to be the sweet spot of helpfulness for this person. You know, we've
Correct. Exactly right. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you.
I did I listened to you in a podcast recently, as you know, and you sort of jokingly raised the idea of harmology, and you did say in that you actually said, actually, we're really talking about helpfulness, you know, is what you said there. But it did sort of just pique my curiosity a bit. Just that idea of obviously there are some scenarios where the harm is quite intentional, and that's, you know, kind of a problem in itself. But sort of the unintended harm, you know, that a person who's perhaps motivated by compassion or by a wish to be helpful, but falling into kind of a situation where perhaps they unintendedly, unwittingly kind of cause harm. Can you sort of speak to that a little bit, those ideas?
Yeah, it's a big worry, this, because I think it's a big problem. I noticed looking back at all my years of research that we were always on the search for positive effects. Okay, that's in the academic research world. Positive, wow, the lengths we used to go to use this methodology and statistical method to locate the positive effect, right? But sitting just below the surface of the water where it was the shadow side, and we never looked at that. We never asked, oh no, we had a negative effect there. I wonder what that was about, right? So looking back, this led me to wonder, well, maybe harm gets caused in the therapy world. And then, of course, it doesn't take me long to reflect about my own personal experience of being in different forms of therapy. And in one case, I think being harmed by it. And so then, if you look outside the therapy, I think in the therapy world, there's some serious questions to ask about harm. And I'd point to the the trauma field as being one. Okay, there are many others. I think there's unintended harm caused by well-intentioned therapists, counselors, who are frankly out of their depth. Okay, quite out of their depth. And the trauma field and the way that's everything is trauma informed carries a dogmatism about how to help people with trauma that I just frankly bewilders me. And I feel that, is it a good idea to always explore the content of trauma? I don't know. And I've thought about it and spoken to people, but boy, oh boy, there's loads of people out there and organizations and counselors who reckon they know exactly how to deal with trauma. And they're probably harming people, okay? But then if you step outside the world of therapy, what I notice is that there's basically unkind behavior. It might be unintended. It might even be motivated by compassion to begin with. It's kind of quite deliberate, but ignorant, unkind behavior, if you like.
Mm.
And you see that all over. Stand on the side of a sports field and watch parents yelling at their kids, coaches yelling at the kids. Parents shouting at kids.
Mm.
Can harm them, you know, we know that. And so there's kind of unkind behavior that is emitted in the service of helpfulness, particularly by deficit detectives. They are at home and at work and in sports and in education. No, don't do this, I do it that way. Bah, 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 bah. With loud voices, and I could tell you some very extreme stories if you know you're interested. And I've been at the receiving end of them in the military when I was a kid. It's unkind behavior, and it's ignorant in the sense that the harm that's been caused, people are unaware of. Hell, that was a bit of a rant from me, Stan. I'm just aware of our conversation kind of, you know, we've had quite a long conversation. We maybe don't have too much more time. So I went on a rant there. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It just a couple of things occurred to me. I mean, it's, you know, the old spoil the, what is it? Spare the rod, spoil the child sort of a thing. You know, that I sometimes hope that we've improved from there or moved on from there, but then you still see it, you know, you still see a version of that metaphor where, you know, tough love or something it's sort of meant to be helpful, but it's kind of like, it's not really helpful. And we kind of all know that it's also not really helpful, but we still sort of do it, you know, shaming people in the area of addictions, for example, and just sort of continuing to perpetuate, you know, the problems for them. People still
and
feel
shaming
like
people. Shaming kids in a classroom goes on all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. Playground, classroom, in the people's own homes. It's going on all the time.
Yeah, there's this that's a classic example really of I think, you know, well, sometimes good intentions, sometimes not so good intentions, but this sort of idea that shame helps somehow, whereas we've really probably got to the point where we know that shaming doesn't help. But also just sort of you know, sort of more minor examples as well, you know, like the advice giving stuff that you were talking about before, and the way that is delivered can actually lead to unintended harms. People might leave a conversation less likely to do the thing that you've advised them to do because of how you approach them to do it, sort of thing. And of course, that's the wisdom of MI, really.
Yeah, and how to translate that and other wisdoms into guidelines for people about how to be helpful is probably a worthwhile effort.
Well, Steve, I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. We went into it open-minded and open-hearted about what we might talk about, and we've come up with sort of compassion and empathy and sympathy, helpfulness, advice giving, and just a little bit at the end there to think about, yeah, or to it's sort of a cautionary tale, really, isn't it? That even when we're trying to be helpful or motivated by compassion, what we do matters, and you know, we have to sort of stop and reflect and maybe even ask the person, you know, like what's helpful for you is kind of perhaps the things that you've suggested there. You're still you know, very active in certain things. You run a few workshops there with our colleague Orla Adams as well, and you're writing this book about giving advice. So where can people sort of engage with you or your sort of the stuff that you're doing? I think you have the website.
Yeah, there is a website which my dear friend Angela looks after for me. So yeah, so you'll find me on the web. I've got a website. You'll find me on
Good.
Google, and one of my sons has dragged me kicking and screaming into Twitter or X or whatever you call it. So I'm on that as well. Yeah.
Yes, okay. Well, Professor Steve Rolnick, thank you very much for coming on Compassion in a T-shirt.
It's a pleasure, man. And send me the t-shirt sometime.
Yes, it's in
Okay.
the mail.
Great stuff. All right. No, wonderful, Stan. Lovely to speak to you and hope to catch you soon, eh?
Yeah.
See you, my man.
Great.
Bye.